Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio from Monday, September 21st, 2020. Here are some of your headlines. President Donald Trump says he plans to announce a Supreme Court nominee to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on Friday or Saturday, and that he has narrowed the list to five candidates. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell again promising that President Trump's nominee will get a confirmation vote on the Senate floor, though he's not saying whether it'll be before or after the election. Democrats are opposing both, and all eyes are on a handful of potential Republican senators who may vote with the Democrats, blocking the effort. Less than 2 weeks until the federal government funding expires, Democrats on the House Rules Committee taking up a bill to avert a shutdown, funding the government through December 11th. But there is a major disagreement with Republicans over money for farmers. We'll get the latest from political reporter Caitlin Emma. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says it's pulled revised guidance from its website that had said airborne transmission was thought to be the main way the coronavirus spreads, saying it was posted in error. And the U.S. imposes new sanctions on Iran over its nuclear program, claiming it's enforcing a U.N. arms embargo and demanding the same from the European Union. But other major powers say the U.S. has no basis for the so-called snapback sanctions because the U.S. withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal. As the fight looms over replacing Supreme Court Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died on Friday at the age of 87, we got some more information today about how she will be honored. The Supreme Court announcing that Ginsburg will lie in repose at the Supreme Court building on Wednesday and Thursday. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing Ginsburg will lie in state in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda on Friday. She will be the second justice of the Supreme Court to get this honor. The other was Chief Justice William Howard Taft, who was also President of the United States. And Ginsburg will be the first woman ever to lie in state. Another woman, Rosa Parks, as a private citizen, lay in honor in the rotunda in 2005. Private internment ceremony for Ginsburg will be held next week at Arlington National Cemetery. President Trump, as he left the White House to campaign in Ohio, telling reporters that he's going to wait until after these memorials and tributes to nominate another justice.
You would announce your Supreme Court pick before Friday?
I would say on Friday or Saturday I'll be announcing the pick. Five women are being looked at and vetted very carefully.
Five.
And we'll make a decision probably Saturday, but Friday or Saturday.
Do you plan to meet with any of them in person? Do you plan to meet with any of them in person before you make your decision?
Yeah, I will.
When do you plan to do that?
During this period of time.
Do you think all five?
I don't know. I doubt it.
But in person?
I doubt it. But we'll meet with a few, probably.
Have you talked to any of them yet?
I have.
Today? On the phone?
Today and yesterday.
Is it better to have a vote on your nominee before the election or after?
Well, I'd much rather have a vote before the election because there's a lot of work to be done, and I'd much rather have it. We have plenty of time to do it. I mean, there's really a lot of time. So let's say I make the announcement on Saturday. There's a great deal of time before the election. That'll be up to Mitch in the Senate.
Yeah.
But I'd certainly much rather have the vote. I think it sends a good signal.
Yeah.
And it's solidarity and lots of other things. And I'm just doing my constitutional obligation. I have an obligation to do this. So I would rather see it before the election.
But are you worried about some senators, Republican senators, who may be a little reluctant?
Well, we'll have to say, I would think that would be very bad for them.
Yeah.
I think their voters, the people that voted them, put them there because of a certain ideology or a certain feel, and they don't want to have somebody do that. I think it's very bad if they do that.
What would be your concern if the last words, supposedly the last wishes of Justice Ginsburg were made up? It supposedly came from her granddaughter.
Yeah, it just sounds to me like it would be somebody else. I don't believe it. Could be. It could be, and it might not be too.
Sir, what would you?
It was just too convenient.
What would be your concern if the vote happened after Election Day?
No concern. I just think it would be better. They asked, would I rather have it? I'd rather have it before the election. I think it would be better for our country, and we'll pick somebody that's outstanding, very qualified. They're all qualified, but somebody that is outstanding, and I'd rather see it all take place before the election, so before November 3rd.
President Trump outside the White House boarding Marine One to be heading to Ohio to do a campaign stop. And referring to Ruth Bader Ginsburg reported final wish not to be replaced until a new president is installed. As President Trump mentioned, the Constitution gives him the power to nominate a Supreme Court justice and gives the U.S. Senate the power to advise and consent. And today on the Senate floor, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell reiterating what he said over the weekend, there will be a vote on President Trump's nominee.
President Trump's nominee for this vacancy will receive a vote on the floor of the Senate. Now, already, some of the same individuals who tried every conceivable dirty trick to obstruct Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh are lining up to proclaim the third time will be the charm. The American people are about to witness an astonishing parade of misrepresentations about the past, misstatements about the present, and more threats against our institutions from the same people who've already been saying for months, well before this, already been saying for months, they want to pack the court.
The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, one of those statements from the past involves 2016, when then President Obama nominated a justice to fill an empty seat months before the presidential election, and that nominee did not get a floor vote. Here's more from Senator McConnell.
Others want to claim this situation is exactly analogous to Justice Scalia's passing in 2016, and so we should not proceed until January. This is also completely false. Here's what I said on the Senate floor the very first session, the day after Justice Scalia passed, quote, the Senate has not filled a vacancy arising in an election year when there was a divided government since 1888, almost 130 years ago. Here's what I said the next day when I spoke to the press for the first time on the subject. You have to go back to 1888 when Grover Cleveland was president to find the last time a vacancy created in a presidential election year was approved by Senate of a different party. As of then, only six prior times in American history had a Supreme Court vacancy arisen in a presidential election year, and the president sent a nomination that year to the Senate of the opposite party. The majority of those times, the outcome was exactly what happened in 2016, no confirmation. The historically normal outcome when you have divided government.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, he can afford to lose three Republican votes and still make what he wants happen, because Vice President Mike Pence, also president of the Senate, can cast a potential tie-breaking vote. So far, two Republican senators say they will not support holding a vote on President Trump's nominee, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Senator McConnell was followed today by the Minority Leader of the Senate, Chuck Schumer.
All the rights enshrined in our Constitution that are supposed to be protected by the Supreme Court of the United States, all the rights that could be undone or unwound by a conservative majority on the court, the right to join a union, marry who you love, freely exercise your right to vote, the right of a parent with a child who has cancer not to watch helpless as their son or daughter suffers without proper health care. If you care about these things and the kind of country we live in, this election and this vacancy mean everything. And by all rights, by every modicum of decency and honor, Leader McConnell and the Republican Senate majority have no right to fill it. No right. In the final few weeks, sensing her failing health, Justice Ginsburg told her family that it was her, quote, most fervent wish that she not be replaced until a new president is installed. That was Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dying wish, her most fervent wish, that she should not be replaced until a new president is installed. The Senate Republican majority should have no problem adhering to Justice Ginsburg's dying wish. Leader McConnell held a Supreme Court vacancy open for nearly a year in order to, quote, give the people a voice in selecting a Supreme Court justice. I just heard the remarks of the Republican leader. It's obvious why he is so defensive. This is what Leader McConnell said in 2016, mere hours after the death of Justice Scalia. Quote, his words, the American people should have a voice in the selection of their next Supreme Court justice. Therefore, this vacancy shall not be filled until we have a new president. No amount of sophistry can change what McConnell said then. And it applies even more so now, more so, so much closer we are to an election.
Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor. You can always watch the Senate live, gavel to gavel, on C-SPAN 2 television or listen on the free C-SPAN radio app, the House as well, on C-SPAN television and on our free app. It's only been a couple of days since the death of Justice Ginsburg, but already there are ads over this vacancy. The conservative Judicial Crisis Network spending $2.2 million on cable in Colorado, Iowa, Maine, and North Carolina. Each has a Republican senator in a tight reelection race. And also Utah, home of Mitt Romney, considered a possible swing vote on whether to confirm President Trump's eventual nominee by Election Day. Here's that ad.
You'll hear noise from extremists about the Supreme Court vacancy. Here are the facts. Justice Ginsburg was confirmed in 42 days. Only three senators voted against her. Justice O'Connor was confirmed in 33 days. It was unanimous. In 8 out of 10 vacancies like this, the nominee was confirmed. Democrats are shamefully trying to change the facts. Tell the Senate, when a strong nominee is named, follow precedent. Confirm the judge.
That ad from the Judicial Crisis Network. Follow the process of the Supreme Court nomination, hearings, and a possible vote on the C-SPAN networks. House of Representatives, meanwhile, began its day with a resolution honoring Justice Ginsburg. Here is Speaker Pelosi presiding.
For what purpose does the gentlewoman from Michigan seek recognition?
Speaker, I offer a privilege resolution and ask for its immediate consideration.
The clerk will report the resolution.
House Resolution 1128, resolved that the House has heard with profound sorrow of the death of the Honorable Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. Resolved that the House tenders its deep sympathy to the members of the family of the late Associate Justice in their bereavement. Resolved that the clerk communicate these resolutions to the Senate and to the Supreme Court and transmit a copy of the same to the family of the late Associate Justice. Resolved that when the House adjourns today, it adjourn as a further mark of respect to the memory of the late Associate Justice.
Thank you. Is there objection to the consideration of the resolution? Without objection, the resolution is agreed to and the motion to reconsider is laid upon the table. Thank
you. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, presiding over the House today. There will be services and memorials the next couple of days as Justice Ginsburg lies in repose at the Supreme Court building and then lies in state in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. You'll be able to listen and watch to all those memorials here on C-SPAN Radio and C-SPAN Television, streamed at C-SPAN.org. Listen anywhere on the free C-SPAN Radio app. This is Washington Today. Congress and the White House have 10 days to act to avoid a federal government shutdown. Current funding expires October 1st. House Democrats introducing a temporary funding extension today called a CR, or continuing resolution, funding the government through early December. First stop is the House Rules Committee, which met virtually today, and the chair is Democrat Jim McGovern.
We will consider H.R. 8319, a continuing resolution to keep the government funded through December 11th. In addition, this legislation extends vital public health programs. Keeping the lights on is the most basic responsibility we have as members of Congress, but it's not always easy, as we all know, especially in an election year. So I want to thank our appropriators for working hard on this to lift the threat of another shutdown.
Jim McGovern chairs the Rules Committee, which will set the rules for House floor debate for this bill, including how much time for debate will be allowed and whether amendments can be offered. A government funding bill needs to pass the House and Senate in the same form and be signed into law by President Trump by October 1st to prevent the shutdown. The Rules Committee ranking Republican Tom Cole said he opposes the current version introduced by the Democrats.
I had originally thought I'd be speaking today on a bipartisan negotiated continuing resolution. Unfortunately, it appears that the speaker's now making unilateral decisions and going a different direction. Despite all sides reaching a deal regarding what would be included in the CR, the text we just received removes key provisions agreed upon related to the Commodity Credit Corporation and an extension of the pandemic EBT food assistance program. This is an unfortunate and unnecessary outcome, in my view, Mr. Chairman. Congress governs best when it governs together. This weekend, I thought we had a bipartisan deal that would fund the government and keep it open so that it can continue to provide critical services to our constituents. This, as I have said many times, both here and on the floor, is one of the highest responsibilities that we have as legislators. But when the majority makes last-minute decisions to renege on bipartisan work, it does not bode well for the legislative process or for the institution. It builds distrust that makes it harder to accomplish great things in the future. I would remind my friends of the proverb, quote, "If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together." Sadly, today, the majority's decided on the former strategy rather than the latter. I'm saddened by that, Mr. Chairman. I would encourage the committee to make an order, an amendment that gives members the opportunity to vote on the original deal on the House floor. And in the meantime, I hope that the majority will see the light and decide that we can go far by going together.
Congressman Tom Cole at today's Rules Committee meeting. Joining us now with more on the continuing resolution is Caitlin Emma, Politico's Appropriations and Budget Reporter. The headline on your story reads, Hill leaders feud over short-term spending bill to avoid shutdown. What is the feud about?
Right. Well, it looks like a deal was coming together late last week, and that is, you know, very much not the case today. Probably the biggest sticking point so far is Democrats' refusal to include tens of billions of dollars in trade relief for farmers who've been affected by President Donald Trump's trade policies. Democrats argue that, you know, there's little accountability over this money and that the president is using the money, sort of exploiting it on the campaign trail in order to boost his reelection chances. But meanwhile, Republicans are accusing Democrats of backing out on a deal to include that money in exchange for $2 billion in pandemic-related food assistance that Democrats had wanted. So both sides are kind of still at an impasse over legislation to fund the government as of right now, and federal funding is set to expire in just about 9 days.
What is the White House position on this farm aid?
The White House actually requested this funding in the first place to provide trade aid for farmers. It is through the Commodity Credit Corporation, which is a Depression-era program intended to help farmers. At the same time, Democrats are arguing that this is not an immediate need, that this can be taken care of in the future. And it's just become one of the biggest sticking points here. And it's really unclear as to who is going to fold. It seems like at the moment that Democrats are waiting for Republicans to eventually fold on this. Meanwhile, the other side is holding out for Democrats to include some funding to ensure that this program doesn't hit its borrowing authority in the coming weeks.
So let's talk about that process. The Democratic House members unveiling their proposal today, the Republican senators saying they don't like this. So what's going to happen to the bill next? Today it's in the Rules Committee. What happens next?
Right. They are House Democrats are really moving full steam ahead with this bill. Like you said, the Rules Committee is meeting on it. They are, you know, going to tee it up for floor debate, and the House is sort of plowing forward with a vote tomorrow. So really, in terms of where Democrats are coming from, they are daring some Republicans to, you know, vote against funding the government over this issue. But as of right now, on Monday afternoon, Democrats are confident that, you know, this will pass through the House. They might lose some votes here and there, but they're pretty sure that they, you know, pretty confident that they have the votes in order to pass this. But again, It does not have full Republican support, so Congress is not really that much closer to a bipartisan deal to keep the government from shutting down on September 30th.
So just one more on process. This means if it passes the House and heads over to the Senate, there's a possibility a different version would pass the Senate, sending it back to the House. This all has to be done by October 1st.
Correct. It's totally possible that, you know, Senate Republicans will come up with their own proposal and that, you know, talks will continue after the House passes this CR. This certainly doesn't have to be the sort of final word on it. But, you know, like I said, time is really running out to negotiate on a package and have it pass through both chambers. That also being said, when Congress wants to, you know, do something, they can get it done very quickly when they put their mind to it.
Other than this disagreement, what funding levels did they agree to? And also, how long will the funding last?
So both sides, while they are disagreeing over, anomalies are the funding and policy exceptions that are usually tacked on to a continuing resolution. So that has been a very contentious part of the debate. But both sides have coalesced seemingly around a December 11th end date. So it would essentially extend current government funding levels to December 11th. So once again, we'll have some sort of, you know, December spending standoff to look forward to in the coming months. But it's essentially, aside from the anomalies that have been included, it will extend current government funding levels until that date. You know, that being said, the legislation put forth by House Democrats includes, you know, some different things there on, you know, disaster aid and ensuring that seniors aren't subjected to a Medicare Part B premium hike. And they included a one-year surface transportation reauthorization extension, sort of things like that. A lot of the anomalies that were included by Democrats are actually bipartisan in nature. But this one issue of, you know, farmer bailout funding to sort of, you know, get some relief from the president's tariffs, that is currently the biggest sticking point.
Caitlin Emma, Appropriations and Budget Reporter with Politico. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, the Dow is down 509, NASDAQ down 14, S&P down 38. It was apparent early Monday stock market was trending downward, and outside the White House, Presidential Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow asked about that. Also about the outlook for the economy if there is not another coronavirus relief package signed into law. Negotiations have been at a standstill for a number of weeks.
It's hard to know what the stock market is day to day because there's been a tech correction that continues to roll. I do think, however, there are some worries that Britain might shut down. It's coming out of London. I can't verify. It's not my job. But I read the reports like everybody else, and I think that's a great concern. The USA is in a much better position, thankfully. We've regained control of the virus, both the cases and the fatalities. But I think people are worried about Britain and maybe the rest of Europe as well.
Larry, could I ask, though, will the economy continue to improve if you don't get a stimulus package?
Yes. I've said this many times. We are in a self-sustaining, strong V-shaped recovery. Now, that battle's not over yet, and there's still a good deal of hardship left. But unemployment having come down to 8.4%, we've created over 10 million jobs, 14 million on the household survey. These are good signs. Strong retailing, strong autos, strong housing. Inventory is going to be rebuilt. So I think the so-called CARES 2 or whatever has elements that could help, which are worth negotiating, to wit, the small business sector. We have long advocated extending the PPP for small business. There's stories in the paper today about the restaurant. We have restaurant industry, which is struggling to come back alive. We have argued from day one to help the small business, including the restaurant. So let's get that done. We want to open up schools, so why don't we get that done? The president favors the direct assistance through checks. So in other words, let's get that done. There are certain things that could help, but I do not think the recovery is contingent on that assistance package. And as long as businesses keep open and stay open, we're in much better shape than we were, although we've got a lot of work to do.
Larry Kudlow is director of the White House National Economic Council, speaking to reporters in the White House driveway. The Congressional Budget Office giving its latest long-term budget forecast today, predicting that due to the economic recess and the coronavirus pandemic, the national debt will rise to 98% of gross domestic product by the end of this year and reach 195% of GDP by 2050. That would demolish the previous record of 106% just after World War II. Back in a minute with more Washington Today.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And welcome back to Washington Today. A couple of more headlines. The Justice Department announcing that New York City, Seattle, and Portland, Oregon would be designated as jurisdictions, quote, permitting violence and destruction of property. This is under President Trump's order from last month requiring federal agencies to submit potential funding cuts for cities that permit anarchy. Canadian police conducting an operation in a suburb of Montreal related to the investigation into an envelope addressed to the White House reportedly containing the poison ricin. Royal Canadian Mounted Police tweeting that its chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and explosives team leading the investigation. A government watchdog says that up to 8.7 million Americans are in danger of missing out on coronavirus relief payments of up to $1,200 per individual because of incomplete IRS and Treasury Department records. The Trump administration today imposing new sanctions on Iran following Saturday's announcement the U.S. will be unilaterally reimposing U.N. sanctions through the snapback process contained within the U.N. resolution that put in place the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and six major powers. Snapback can be triggered if Iran is in significant non-performance with its obligations under the accord. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo leading off today's news conference at the State Department.
I was at the White House last week for the Abraham Accords, a great step forward towards peace in the Middle East. And today I'm proud to announce how the Trump administration is taking even more action to further that same goal and protect the American people. Over the weekend, the U.S. effort to restore virtually all previously terminated U.N. sanctions on the Islamic Republic of Iran, including the arms embargo, pursuant to U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231. The Trump administration has always been honest about what the Iranian regime really is, a radical revolutionary and the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism and anti-Semitism. President Trump understood that the JCPOA was a abject failure. It didn't bring Iran into the community of nations or block Tehran's path to a nuclear weapon. Instead, it was an exercise in appeasement. It gifted the regime billions and paved the way for Iran to become the arms dealer of choice for terrorist groups and dictators all across the world in just 5 short years. Just imagine what Iran would do if we were able to freely purchase more advanced weapons. We have no intention of letting that happen. The president's executive order announced today gives us a new and powerful tool to enforce the UN arms embargo and hold those who seek to evade UN sanctions accountable. Today, I will take the first action under this new executive order by sanctioning the Iranian Ministry of Defense and Armed Forces Logistics and Iran's Defense Industries Organization and its director. We're also sanctioning the previous president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, For nearly 2 years, corrupt officials in Tehran have worked with the illegitimate regime in Venezuela to flout the UN arms embargo. Our actions today are a warning that should be heard worldwide. No matter who you are, if you violate the UN arms embargo on Iran, you risk sanctions. I'm also announcing sanctions on Hamid Reza Gardarani and Ahmad Shivai under an existing U.S. authority targeting proliferators of weapons of mass destruction. These individuals are central to Iran's uranium enrichment operations.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He was joined by the Defense Secretary Mark Esper, the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, and the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who announced sanctions as well. During the question and answer period with reporters, Secretary Pompeo asked why the U.S. is doing all this alone.
Jean Marais, DPA, right here.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Secretary Pompeo, the E3 countries are not engaging with the U.S. claim that it triggered the snapback. They even called it incapable of having any legal effect. What measures specifically is the Trump administration planning to bring Germany and the other countries in line?
So two things. First, the country that's isolated today is not the United States, but rather Iran. By these actions, we have made very clear that every member state in the United Nations has a responsibility to enforce these sanctions. That certainly includes the United Kingdom, France, and Germany. We will have every expectation that those nations enforce these sanctions. Second, if you are serious about peace in the Middle East, if you're serious about denying the main threat in the Middle East, I think Europeans understand the risk to their countries and where it emanates from. The place is the Islamic Republic of Iran, so I'm very confident that the people of those countries feel more secure today. And indeed, privately, their governments tell us they don't want the arms embargo lifted either. Indeed, in their letter to the United Nations, they suggested that they, too, wished that the arms embargo were extended. The good news is the United States is going to make sure it happens. We're going to take the action that is necessary to actually deliver on what the E3 tells us they have as their objective. I wish that they would join us in this. We've had this dispute about the merits of the JCPOA that's been going on since the Trump administration has come into place. The world should know that the United States will stand to make sure that the arms embargo is extended, that the Security Council resolutions come back to place, and that the European people will be safer as a result of the actions that the United States government has taken today.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, the EU3, also known as the Big Three, are France, Germany, and Italy. And most of the UN Security Council members are calling the U.S. actions illegal because President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. The Iranian President Hassan Rouhani telling an Iranian news agency, "Today we can say that the maximum U.S. pressure against the Iranian nation in the political and legal fields has not only failed, but also turned into the maximum isolation of the United States." 2020 is the 75th anniversary of the creation of the United Nations, and today at UN headquarters in New York City, there was an official ceremony. Here are the remarks from the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres.
It took two world wars, millions of deaths, and the horrors of the Holocaust for world leaders to commit to international cooperation and rule of law. That commitment produced results. A third world war, which so many had feared, has been avoided. Never in modern history have we gone so many years without a military confrontation between the major powers. This is a great achievement of which member states can be proud and which we must all strive to preserve. Down the decades, there have been other historic accomplishments, including peace treaties and peacekeeping, decolonization, human rights standards and the mechanisms to uphold them, the triumph over apartheid, life-saving humanitarian aid for millions of victims of conflict and disaster, the eradication of diseases, the steady reduction of hunger, the progressive development of international law, landmark pacts to protect the environment and our planet. And most recently, unanimous support for the Sustainable Development Goals and the Paris Agreement on Climate Change provided an inspiring vision for the 21st century. Yet, there is still so much to be done. Of the 850 delegates to the San Francisco conference, just 8 were women. 25 years since the Beijing Platform for Action, gender inequality remains the greatest single challenge to human rights around the world. Climate calamity looms. Biodiversity is collapsing. Poverty is again rising. Hatred is spreading. Geopolitical tensions are escalating, and nuclear weapons remain on air trigger alert. Transformative technologies have opened up new opportunities, but also exposed new threats. And the COVID-19 pandemic has laid bare the world's fragilities. We can only address them together.
Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, at UN headquarters in New York City. The 75th UN General Assembly opened on September 15th, and it's been mostly virtual due to the coronavirus pandemic. On that pandemic today, the World Health Organization urging more wealthy countries to join its new agreement on distributing a coronavirus vaccine once it's developed. More than 150 countries are part of the COVID-19 Vaccines Global Access Facility, also known as COVAX, representing 64% of the world's population. Not part of the group, China and the United States. The WHO leader, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, spoke at a news conference in Geneva.
The COVAX facility will help to bring the pandemic under control, save lives, accelerate the economic recovery, and ensure that the race for vaccines is a collaboration, not a contest. This is not charity. It's in every country's best interest. We sink or we swim together. The fastest route to ending the pandemic and accelerating the global economic recovery is to ensure some people are vaccinated in all countries, not all people in some countries. Recent opinion polls show the overwhelming majority of people support equitable access to vaccines. Our aim is to have 2 billion doses of vaccine available by the end of 2021.
WHO Director General Dr. Tedros. He says so far $3 billion has been pledged to this COVAX facility, but the effort needs 10 times as much to succeed. Back in the U.S., California Governor Gavin Newsom giving an update on the historic wildfires burning in his state and other western states. 3.6 million acres burned in 2020 compared to just 157,000 acres in 2019. Said this year there have been at least 26 deaths and 6,400 structures destroyed, and there are currently 27 major fires burning. He spoke about a few of them.
I wanted to highlight just a few other fires that have gotten a lot of attention, and deservingly so. The Bobcat Fire in L.A. County was at 3% containment, 44,000 acres burned when we last updated you, 15% today. But you could see more than doubling total number of acreage that have been lost in this fire, 105,000 acres now being impacted. So we're putting as many resources as we possibly can on that fire. Again, our mutual aid system that exists within the state of California and outside the state of California, some 15 mutual aid states are helping either the National Guard or CAL FIRE directly. And we're putting all the resources we possibly can on all of these complexes, but focusing, as we should, on that Bobcat Fire as well as the El Dorado Fire, which we made some progress last week, 60% containment on that fire, 18,000 acres. But this fire continues to be stubborn. As you can see, we've gone backwards just modestly in terms of total percentage contained. And you could see an increase of about 5,000 acres over the last week. So between the Bobcat and the El Dorado fire, obviously stubborn fires, impactful, and we continue to do our best to address those complexes and those wildfires.
California Governor Gavin Newsom in Sacramento. As his state and other states in the Pacific Northwest continue to deal with these wildfires, there's another concern for the nearly 80 million people who live in the western U.S. health effects of thick smoke. And the EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler asked about this problem during a discussion hosted by the American Enterprise Institute.
Our next audience question comes from Oliver Millman. He's a writer for The Guardian. He says, the fourth National Climate Assessment, co-authored by EPA scientists, states that climate change has doubled the area burned by wildfire in the U.S. West since the 1980s. His question is, given the huge fires we're now seeing out west, do you consider wildfire smoke a major and growing public health threat?
There's several things in that question.
Right.
His final question is on the health threat of the smoke. Absolutely. We actually, our career scientists developed an app that you can download. It's called Smoke Sense, that will give updates as to where you live and whether or not it's safe to go outside and because of the particulate matter from the fires. Absolutely, the forest fires are creating a huge health issue in terms of particulate matter. I should have started with the loss of life from the fires.
Yeah.
And you know, we're all very concerned about the loss of life and the emergency responders, but there's certainly an environmental impact, and that's in the smoke as well as impacts to water. You know, after the wildfires in Colorado a few years back, they had water impacts for years afterwards. So there's a lot of environmental impacts. But I believe that the forest fires in the West are mostly caused by poor forest management and not from climate change.
EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler. Smoke from the U.S. West Coast fires has drifted as far away as Europe. Thanks for joining us on Washington Today. Be sure to download the free C-SPAN Radio app to listen to us anywhere and also get our podcasts, also available at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Have a good night.